Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, Republicans walk away from the table during a budget meeting with the vice president. Was it something he said? Michelle Bachmann is now officially in the race for president, but the Republicans are not lining up to fill her seat. She did announce she was running, right? The U.S. backs former French finance minister Christine Lagarde to head the IMF. Ça, c'est bon. This and more today on Backroom Politics. And it's Tuesday here in Washington, D.C. on a hot Tuesday afternoon in the nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital on Blog Talk Radio. Joining me as they do every Tuesday from 4 to 6 Eastern Time, to my left, he is the former 8-term member of Congress from Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is Congressman Al Swift. Congressman, welcome back.
I'm delighted to be here.
And sitting directly across from me, as he is every Tuesday, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation and venerable parliamentarian of the House of Representatives. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, why are you shaking your head now?
I was not the parliamentarian of the House.
I said venerable parliamentarian. I didn't say you were the parliamentarian. Come on.
Well, he's certainly venerable.
He's certainly vulnerable at times, too. Sitting to my right, as he is every Tuesday, is the vice president of the Eurasia Center. He is the head of business development for the Eurasia Center. He is also a bar-certified attorney in the great state of New York and your nation's capital, D.C. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be with everyone.
And we've got a few people here in the smoke-encompassed nerve center of Backroom Politics, including our old friend Frank the Bodyguard. Frank's joining us as a guest today. So we got a lot to get to. It's been a busy week here in Washington, D.C. The big news still coming out of Washington, surprise, surprise, is the continuing fiscal crisis facing the nation. It is all-encompassing. It has global impact. It has local impact. It has national impact. But the news coming out of Washington today was within the past couple of hours, the International Monetary Fund has, in fact, confirmed Christine Lagarde, the former French finance minister, is, in fact, going to be the new head of the International Monetary Fund. Now, we've got views from both sides, for and against, but Ralph, being our international pundit, first of all, what does Christine Lagarde bring to the table as far as the global economy? She's been pretty conservative when it comes to bailouts, when it comes to international support to emerging countries. What does she bring to the table?
She has strong support and credibility with the Chinese, which are sort of, they're not part of the G8, they're part of the G20, but the Chinese still wield a lot of political clout and influence. And she's well-respected within the European community. She's has extensive business experience. But she has been very outspoken about her unwillingness to support the Greek bailout plan. And this has led to massive demonstrations in Greece.
Which are now apparently are becoming a daily occurrence. You wake up in Greece, you go, I'll protest. We got nothing better to do because we're certainly not getting paid by the government. We're out of work.
The last time this kind of demonstrations happened in Greece, there was a major reshuffling of the cabinet, so watch out for that.
Is that on the horizon, do you think?
It's possible. And Christine Lagarde, I don't think, helped her position by being so outspoken about the Greek bailout.
If she's not supportive of the Greek bailout, even though the IMF and the G8 have come out saying we're going to have to do this, is there going to be some sort of shift in the moving forward with the IMF with her at the helm?
I think you'll see a shift. I mean, she's fiscally conservative, like you said, and I understand her position, because it's really unfair for the other G8 member countries to have to bail out Greece because of their financial situation. However, at the same time, if you don't bail out Greece, it's going to lead to severe international repercussions.
And we invite anybody who's listening to join in the discussion about this or any of the topics we talked today. You can call in at 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. Bob, before the show, we were talking about Christine Lagarde becoming the new head of the IMF. You're not a fan. You don't think this is a good idea. Why?
I don't. I would have thought that the International Monetary Fund would have been wise to pick someone other than another European. There was a candidate who I believe was the finance minister of Mexico, who was highly regarded for his abilities. I believe he worked for the IMF for a number of years earlier. I would think some of the third world countries, Asia, would have liked to see someone other than another European, and I think it would have been wise for the Europeans to back down a little bit, particularly in view of the fact that they are so divided over what to do about Greece.
Well, here's the question, though. With the overwhelming membership that is in Europe of the GA, three of them being England, France, and Germany, don't you think that the Europeans are going to want to have their voice heard in the global economy as opposed to somebody in what could be considered a developing economy like Mexico?
The idea that Europe isn't going to be heard boggles the mind. They talk all the time. I don't think they would be lacking in being heard.
But you would probably... Go ahead, Ralph.
I think at some point they will break the tradition and appoint someone outside of Europe to be head of the IMF. I just don't think this was the right time. Now, Christine Lagarde has huge shoulders to fill, and she's got a lot to prove now that she's in power. But I think getting the support from China was crucial, because they play a large political role in the relationship
with
Europe.
But hearing Ralph talk, it almost seems like the IMF was almost somewhat beholden to the Chinese.
The thing is, the G8 member countries are struggling. They don't have the funds. China is the one that has the money, and they are spending close to $2 trillion in FDI that could come into the U.S. over the next few years.
But doesn't that send kind of the wrong message globally as far as our economic or the global economy as a whole? It almost digresses the power that Europe and the U.S. has by being beholden to China.
Yeah, but we spent the last 60, 70 years being the big elephant in the room. China has now joined us. Whether it's as big as we are or only almost as big as we are is yet to be determined. But you can't ignore China. So I don't know whether we need to start pulling our forelocks. But I don't think that's what this action demonstrated anyway.
But when we see, Ralph, for you to say that, she's got strong connections to China, China is literally sitting there. Eventually they're going to have to be brought up to G8 status. Somebody's going to have to leave, and they're going to have to be replaced.
Well, she has the relationships with China. She's dealt with them in the past, and that's key. She understands their mentality and their mindset. That's why you see her as a fiscal conservative.
But
she's following along their lines. I don't think China would necessarily want to bail out Greece.
But
they would almost take the same position as her.
But doesn't this de facto make them a G8 power versus a G20 power?
That's true. And there's a lot of talk about whether you bring them into the G8 or whether China wants to be in the G8 for that matter. They are in the G20, and maybe they feel they don't need to be in the G8, but they want to have the sphere of influence.
Well, the G8 has long been, Bob.
What's wrong with the G9?
Right.
Well,
absolutely.
Again, that's the question. The G8 has long been the de facto motivator for a global economy. It's when the eight largest economies in the world.
Yeah.
Can you in fact have a G8 without China being involved?
Well, as a practical matter, I'm not a financial wizard, so I don't know, and I'll refer to my colleague on my left. But the fact of the matter is, they ought to be there to begin with.
Ralph?
The G8 no longer controls the lion's share of the world economy. You have China that has stepped into that role. When I was at the G8 and they were talking about the billions of dollars that they want to allocate to Egypt and Tunisia to help develop institutions and structure resulting from the Arab Spring, my first thought is, where is this money coming from? European countries don't have it. So someone else is going to have to come in and provide this kind of funding. It's going to come from China and maybe some other countries.
Traditionally, what has been the role of China in the IMF? They've been kind of a silent player for many, many years,
right.
But it seems that they're getting a little bit louder in their voice in how the IMF is operated. Is that a good assessment?
That's a very good assessment, and I think the G8 member countries recognize they have to have a strong partnership with China. And that's why you have people like Christine Lagarde and Jean-David Levitch, who is Sarkozy's right-hand man, who have extensive experience in negotiating and understanding the Chinese mindset.
But Al, this has got to be sending a message just to the general electorate here in the United States of, hey, we're no longer the 800-pound gorilla. We're now maybe slimming down to about 650. Are Americans at the electorate level ready to see a country like China take a role as a prominent economic player, or do they even care?
I don't know that they have anything to say about it. It's just going to happen, we should take it as a reality and recognize they're a major competitor, and we should play our cards that way. In short, we don't have to hug them and kiss them and love them, but this whole trend that Newt Gingrich started talking about, American exceptionalism, couldn't have come at a worse time to say that we are somehow individually and collectively better than anyone else. When you've got China looming up behind you, it kind of suggests maybe there are these two exceptional countries. We've got to get used to it. And we shouldn't get all nervous about it. I mean, things change.
We've been seeing, Chinese companies have been wanting to do business in the U.S. They've been thwarted by congressional and by legal issues. Are we at a point, and this may be a little early to tell, but are we at a point right now where we could see a financial cold war between China and the U.S.? Is that a reality? And what would a financial cold war between those two countries look like?
Well, I think it could reach that point because more and more Chinese companies get blocked when they try and come over here to do business. There's a lot of support within China to get their companies over here, but the Chinese people don't feel they're going to be welcome. So it's much easier to go to other countries, to Iran or to Russia or to Venezuela, where they can get in and engage in business and commerce.
I think the smart policy would be to get the Chinese in under the tent as soon as possible in every way possible.
Absolutely.
We can use their money
to
help with the European financial situation.
And the technology that can be generated. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in green energy.
And the business that would be good for them will also be good for us. So the idea that we're going to somehow prevent them from getting any larger is nonsense. Get them inside where you keep an eye on them.
But Bob,
American companies in China are going to prosper that way. You won't see as much aversion when you're an American company trying to do business in China.
Well, that brings up a good point
because
one of the things that we found, I found in talking with American companies that are trying to do business, I mean, we've seen successful companies. GM, one of GM's largest markets right now isn't the U.S., it's China.
Right.
We're seeing companies like GM, we're seeing companies like GE, we're seeing companies like Chrysler, Ford, starting to make maneuvers in there. Are we at a point where maybe the longer we keep pushing out, we're going to see that market diminish for American companies that are doing business over there? The financial institutions are going to be huge over there.
Right, absolutely. I mean, it would open up opportunities for European and Middle Eastern firms to kind of fill the void. So that's what you have to worry about. You want to make sure American companies can compete on an equal footing in China.
Frank, would China's history of using quote-unquote substandards material and products, we've had problems enforcing them. When I was in Ohio, we had to go through our new home and look at the particle board, the drywall, because of the inferior. Are they that big that they just say, we're not going to, we want to be in the United States, we want to bring our products over technically unrestricted. Are they going to play ball? Are they going to play by the rules? Or are they just going to say, we're too big, if you want us in, you got to let us give out substandard?
The problem is quality control was never an issue in China because everything was literally made by hand.
Right.
Now, with some of the abuses that have come out in the media, the Chinese government has recognized this is bad publicity. It's going to hurt.
So they will play. You feel they will play ball?
I think they recognize it hurts their prestige internationally and their ability to do business. So they're going to continue to improve their standards.
Let's step back a minute and just look at this. And Ralph, I'd like you to jump in on this too, because China, with their one-child policy, you know, they've got a real demographic problem, bigger than any country in the world has ever had. And it's coming like a freight train, and they know it. Now, I don't think that they're going to be, you know, tromping all over the world, because they're going to have a lot of troubles at home taking care of what they need at home.
Well, that actually brings up a good point.
And I think Ralph can probably talk about this better than anybody.
Right. Actually, the question becomes is, with the lack of a defined labor pool coming down in the next generation, I mean, we're literally 10 years out from a labor shortage in China.
Yeah.
Are we going to see the importation of possibly American talent going over there?
That's entirely possible. Not right away, but maybe in the next 50, 60 years. You could have people from other countries, the Middle East or Africa, coming over, which has traditionally happened in China. They brought over people to work.
The one labor force that I see that China's been hitting quite extensively is India.
Yeah.
There's a lot of talent migration going from India over to China. And I've even heard instances where Japan is getting tapped, which Japan can't afford that either.
Well, if you're a major Japanese company, you can get into China. It's the small and medium-sized Japanese companies that have a hard time just because of the traditional animosity that the Chinese have towards the Japanese. But as we become more global, if the U.S. markets are shut off to Chinese, you're going to see India and some of the major Japanese corporations, more European and Middle East, filling the void. So U.S. has to be very mindful of what's going on. And the whole issue with the one-child policy that Bob has brought up, remember, it only applied to the Han. It did not apply to the ethnic minorities within China, of which there are 55 different groups. It also didn't apply if you were an only child and your parents were only children. So there were like four or five other exceptions. The problem that you see now in China is the average upper middle class family in China wants to provide the very best for their child in terms of education, housing, employment. They want to create the American dream. Well, that costs money, and the mindset of this middle class in China is they don't want another child because it's going to be too expensive to educate and give them the best opportunities that they want for the kids.
But Al, do you see Congress actually backing off on the FISA requirements as far as the investigation of Chinese companies coming in and the strict legal overcoat that they have to bear to come in and do business here? Is Congress ready to move on that, or is it too soon?
Well, I don't think it's too soon to give that some serious thought. You need to look into to what degree. See, our worry was they were going to steal all our technology. I think they got it all. I don't know that there's much of it left to steal. So just in concrete terms, do those restrictions protect us in any way? And maybe if there are some of them that do, we should continue them. But for those that are just there because we're paranoid, we should get rid of them.
I think an interesting point to make is if you read the China Commission report that came out, and I met with one of the reps a while back, and they're very critical of China, obviously. But the one area...
What are they critical of?
Well, human rights, democracy, the currency is a big issue with them. But the one area where they said that there has been improvement, and they credit the Chinese for working on the issue, is intellectual property. And what's happened is you've had the ABA, you've had lawyers, you've had better education and enforcement violations of intellectual property. What people have to remember is under traditional Chinese society, especially under this Marxist-Leninist system that they adopted, whatever I had was yours. There was no concept of private property ownership. Everything belonged to the collective. So whatever I had to be shared with my brothers and sisters and my comrades. If I didn't, I was not a true comrade. I was not a true supporter of the revolution, of the idea of promoting equality among the community. When China started to liberalize and allow their own people to set up companies, different products and different were generated among the Chinese themselves. So they were starting to compete with each other for a market share. That meant different Chinese were copying other Chinese brands. So it became an issue on the domestic level. But they never really were able to solve it because they didn't have the proper education and training. So when they opened up internationally, that's when you saw the problems with intellectual property and patent infringement.
Let's get back to the IMF question.
Yeah.
Does the IMF, with Christine Lagarde there as the head of the IMF, does the International Monetary Fund have the stroke internationally to force the hand of the U.S. to create possibly a free trade agreement with China? Are we going to possibly see that, or is that something that's just completely off the table?
I think for right now, because domestic concerns are so imperative, we have to get our fiscal situation in order. You're going to see that put on the back burner. But I think in the near future, it's obviously a very good idea. You believe in what Kissinger says. We have to have a collaborative working relationship with the Chinese where we solve work on issues together based on mutual respect. That's going to be the key to moving both countries forward through the next generation.
Are we going to see continued pressure from the IMF and Christine Lagarde in particular with the relationship she has with Beijing? Is she going to continue to put pressure on the United States to open up the borders for the Chinese economy?
I think that I'm hoping she will. That she will help to move the relationship forward in her capacity. But it's too early to tell.
Bob.
One last thought about the Chinese. They have coming up one of their big changes in leadership next year.
Absolutely.
And it's a new generation. Yeah. It's a generation of the children of the older generation, to be sure. But these are well educated for the most part in Western universities, and they're much more sophisticated, you know, in a worldly sense maybe than the previous and the current leadership. That is going to be maybe the biggest change, and given that and the demographic problems, I mean, I think China is. I mean, I don't see unless a lot of countries decide to go around and downgrade China or diminish them in politically in a sense of not treating them as an equal, then there'll be a problem. But I don't see that happening, and I see the new Chinese leadership being more than willing to make some reasonable accommodations as they see the rest of the world is willing to welcome them in.
And
they're much
new,
more open.
And this new generation that's coming up in China, they don't remember the Cultural Revolution.
They're more familiar with Tiananmen Square than they are with the Maoist Revolution.
Right. And they, as Bob said, they have been educated in the West. And they're bringing new ideas and a new mindset to Chinese political thought and discourse.
Well, we're coming up on the break right now. This is obviously a subject we're going to be talking about in great depth later on as the show progresses. But when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the current economic crisis here in the United States. Republican leadership walking out of a meeting with the Vice President's Financial Crisis Cabinet is a huge telltale sign. Whether it was calculated or not is up for debate. But this is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Thank you. And we're back here live in Chili's back room in the Smoking Compass nerve center of backroom politics. And we're going to switch topics. Al, you look puzzled.
I'm just wondering, how do you, smoke encompassed?
Yeah, the smoke is encompassing the whole room as we speak.
He's on a roll, leave him alone.
Okay. Yeah.
Continue.
Yeah, thank you. We're gonna switch a little bit and talk about the current financial crisis looming over the U.S. economy. That dialogue continues to get stalled. Last week, the vice president held a financial cabinet meeting of congressional leaders at the White House, and led by Majority Leader Eric Cantor, the Republican delegation pretty much wholeheartedly walked out of the discussions. According to news reports, the Republican Party walked out as a result of just no progress being made in the fiscal crisis discussions. Bob, we were talking about this earlier. You seem to think it might have been a calculated move.
I do.
Why?
What I believe is that the vice president's talks had identified a substantial amount of cuts that could be made in programmatic government programs. So there was a lot of good things on the table. But when the vice president turned to talking about taxes, they said, "No, we're not going to do that. We got to get the president involved," and I think that was the key. I think the way to get the president involved, which he should have been for the last 3 months, in my view, is to say the guy who is in charge is going to have to make some decisions, and we want to talk to him.
Yeah, but Alan,
now there were talks today already. Yesterday, the president met with the Senate Minority Leader, Mr. McConnell,
right.
And I believe he's meeting with the Speaker today.
Today.
But if it isn't today, it'll be very quickly, because I think there's where the conversations have to be. And they needed to be there since January.
Al, you were cringing during Bob's talk there for a second. What cringes
well,
you?
His explanation may explain my conundrum here. I have always found in this town that when somebody does something really stupid, you shouldn't take it at face value, because there aren't a lot of really stupid people in this town. There's usually something behind it going on. Now, I thought Cantor and others leaving saying we will not even discuss tax increases was really stupid, because if they mean it, they mean that there'll be no progress at all. And if they don't mean it, they just have climbed higher out on a limb that they're going to have to crawl back off of when they finally do some compromises on that. So there is something more going on, and Bob has kind of hinted at one of the possibilities, that this was an effort to try and jar something loose. I still think the way it was done is dumb.
Well, you look at what Harry Reid said in a discussion. There's a great article in our friends at Politico this morning about revenue versus cuts in the debt debate, and Politico quotes Harry Reid as saying, "The issue isn't what we're willing to do, it's what they, the Republicans, are willing to do." It almost seems like he's drawing a line in the sand right now when it comes to tax increases to alleviate some of the debt pressure that's on us. Al, I mean, is that a smart move? I mean, coming out in the media and saying, hey, the ball's in the Republicans' court.
Well, it is. the Democrats have appeared to be, we don't know exactly what the specifics are, but the Democrats have appeared to make some accommodations in some of the areas that are closest to their hearts. And the Republicans have so far not admitted to making any specific cuts in programs that are important to them, though there's some hint that they may go along with some cuts in the military.
Can't you focus on cutting tax expenditures as a way to avoid raising taxes?
Well, if they will go along with a little change of terminology, then, as Bob has pointed out many times, there are all kinds of revenue that can be received by eliminating tax expenditures, meaning giveaways, that count in the billions. So that's something. Now, will the Republicans say, no, 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 that's a tax increase. That's taking away a tax increase.
Well,
I don't know.
The Tea Party people probably would say just that. And that may be, you know, you've got to take a look at it from the standpoint of getting down to the nitty-gritty here at the 11th hour, just about. The only way you're going to probably get a deal is if the leadership in the House, Mr. Boehner and his leadership, are able to convince the Tea Party people that the Democrats' offers that they're making, and well, I suppose there will have to be probably a little bit more, too, with respect to cutting in the programs, will let the Tea Party people say, well, we, as long as it isn't a increase in the tax rates, we'll go for some of these tax expenditure reductions or eliminations. And
that's a different thing. Yeah. Let me go back to Justin's initial question, though. Was Harry Reid doing something stupid by saying the ball is in their court? I do not think so. The Republicans have been playing a very hard-nosed game, and the Democrats seem to be kind of giving a little here and giving a little there and giving some more and what have you. And there's a school of thought within the Democratic Party that says it's about time we get hard-nosed too, and that may be part of what Harry
Reid is doing. And this is an interesting point I'm going to make. The Democrats have been seriously considering the imposition of a second stimulus package, claiming because the first stimulus didn't work, we need a second stimulus to get us out of the recession. They would do this in return for agreeing to raise the debt limit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and to get back to what Harry Reid said a couple days ago, he said something very interesting after the Republicans left the Boehner meetings. He said, well, now it comes down to the fact that it's got to be me and the Speaker and McConnell and the President. We ought to sit down and talk. That's what we have to do. He said that last week. And I think that's exactly right.
So, but again, you know, it goes back to a topic that we've been talking about for weeks on this show of where's the President in all this? You know, one of the great arguments I heard this weekend is the president's basically taking a parliamentarian view on the budget crisis, letting all the ministers in Congress, or in this case Parliament, deal with the issue, and then at the last minute he'll come in and say, "Hurrah, we have a conclusion," instead of driving policy forward through offices like OMB, helping drive, you know, some of these issues through CBO. He's been nowhere to be seen.
Well, this is almost the way he operated during the health care deal.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and
it seems to be his style.
It seems to be his style to let every, you know, he talks about it from, you know, the pontificate of the presidency, and he talks about it in his speech, but he doesn't get in and mix it up. He lets the other people do it, and then he wants to come in at the end and bless it.
But
it doesn't work here.
But at some point, simple economics has got to come into this and say, hey, wait a minute. You know, you cannot spend what you don't have. Thus, we've gotten to the debt ceiling crisis.
And this is my point. The Democrats will say, well, we'll agree to raise the debt ceiling, but you're going to have to pass a second stimulus package in order to get this country out of a recession.
But again, it goes back to we're spending money we don't have. The stimulus package is all based on what we have in revenue in the coffers right now. That doesn't make sense. Now, if you talk about, you know, finding, when we saw the Erskine-Bowles Commission come back and say, hey, we're looking for $4.2 billion. Here's the roadmap for it. When you look at the chairman of the Finance Committee, gentleman from Wisconsin, Paul Ryan's budget, here's the roadmap. But when you go to the White House and you talk to the Vice President, it seems everybody seems to forget that roadmap's out there.
Well, people don't. You know, some of these Democrats don't care. They feel that a second stimulus is what's needed, and that's going to get us out of this recession, whether it's rational or not.
And there are people like Kent Conrad, who's the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, who is saying that Biden's group hasn't gone far enough in cutting expenditures. And I just think he says, I can't vote for what I hear is coming out of that group if that's all they're doing, because we've got to cut more, like I'm proposing. and myself, and I'm trying. He's been trying to push something through his committee, which he can't get out because the leadership doesn't want it out.
Yeah. So, is the roadblock? I mean, now we get into a situation of which came first, the chicken or the egg. Who's blocking this more? Is it the Democrats in the Senate that don't want to take it up, or is it the Tea Party in the House that wants to continue to create tax cuts, i.e., the Bush era tax cut
you
extension?
Just named the two bad guys in the game.
Oh, we don't want home bad guys, but there are definitely some obstacles that have to be overcome here.
The bottom line is you're going to have to radically slash government, but nobody's willing to do that.
And you have both people in both parties, in both houses, have problems with their own party's positions at this point, the leadership position.
Oh, no question. The Senate's got the Blue Dog Democrats who are sitting there saying, look, we got to get movement on this. You know, we've got some key Senate races that are coming up for re-election after this Congress goes to recess. They're going to have to go back to their constituency with some sort of resolution to this. Even Congressman Boehner wants to put this issue behind him. He does not want to go into 2012 with this still being the top news item every night.
Nobody in their right mind would want to go into next year with this problem hanging over their heads.
So Al, you know, if you were in Congress as a member of the minority, how do you drive a deal with such a divided majority in the House? Or is it possible?
You have to be really inside to know how to answer that question. For example, we assume that the vice president's group has not taken a look at Ryan's, has not taken a look at Simpson and these other proposals that have been made. I would suspect that they have taken a look at all of those things and maybe pulling pieces from all of them together. So I don't think they're flying as blind as they may appear to.
No, there's no, I mean, I think Simpson-Bowles' proposal probably covered the waterfront more broadly than any other proposal that's yet come up, because they included things like Medicare in their proposal.
Right.
I mean, so they ended with something that Ryan didn't do in his budget proposal.
Right.
And most apparently that hasn't come up in the
vice president's talks. Absolutely not.
So then, I mean, because that's such a no-no for the Democrats.
But then we look at somebody like John Kyle out of Arizona, who brings up the issue of the $400 billion in tax revenues that were being discussed by the Democrats as part of the final bargaining. And he said, you know, basically, it's not on the table right now. We may go back to the table. Well, if it's going to go back on the table, why not stay at the table and bring it up at that point instead of going through the kabuki dance that we see Congress and the White House doing?
Because the Republicans are trying to get the president to the table himself. I think that's what's going on.
But is the president really that critical in your eyes, Al, to make this thing go forward?
I don't understand why the vice president clearly has delegated authority from the president isn't good enough.
That was my question.
It's a reasonable question.
But the Republicans apparently don't feel that way.
It almost seems to me like the Republicans are sitting there saying, look, you know, we don't want the vice president. It actually almost seems to me that the president's trying to keep himself isolated for political purposes. So this way he can come back and say, hey, look, I have nothing to do with it. Go talk to my vice president.
But the problem is he has a real problem with independents who abandoned the Democratic Party in the last election.
But Al, you were shaking your head at that comment, though.
Well, I just don't think that he thinks that way. I think that he clearly's got a style, and history will tell us whether it was a good one or a bad one. It doesn't seem to be faring very well on the health bill, and it doesn't seem to be faring very well on this. But this vice president is not just any old vice president.
Right.
And this vice president is probably more qualified to go in and help shape this and protect the Democratic concerns and so forth, frankly, than the president is. And I doubt seriously if you're going to see the president cut him loose. That's like cutting your arm off.
Bob, but that brings up a very good point. Is are the Republicans banking on the lack of experience that the president has in this issue to say, hey, if we get him to the table, we can pretty much, you know, roughshod him across the holes?
He's going to have the vice president right there
next to him. I don't think that's true at all. I think most, let me put it this way, the country understands that there's only one president. The president's the guy, it's his administration, he has to make the decisions. Let's put him at the table. The public will probably be more inclined to agree to something that the president has been a major factor in developing than any other person. And the president isn't there yet. And so it may be that the vice president has all the authority that the president could possibly give him, but he's not the president. And I think Al is right. I mean, you couldn't pick a better negotiator for the Democrats than a man who spent his entire public life in the last 40 years in Congress. He has been around for since he was a 25-year, 30-year-old person. And he has never been a rigid party guy. He's always been a guy you can talk with. And I think he's a very good negotiator, but he's not the president. And I think the reality is, I think the Republicans are looking to make sure they get the guy who the public understands is the decision maker at the table.
Ralph.
Biden is trying to set himself up, obviously, to run for president after 2016. So I think he's in good stead.
Oh, I doubt that.
He has to get in the limelight.
No,
he has to bring people
I disagree with you. In fact, what I see, and I'm a huge fan of Joe Biden, even as a Republican,
right.
I'm a huge fan of Joe Biden. I like the fact that he opens his mouth, just roll tape. Anything that comes out of his mouth might be a good soundbite. But I also like the fact that he is the one sage voice in the administration that has the most experience. He's got the most credibility with the Hill. Bringing him to the table, and
I'm not saying it's a bad thing.
I don't think he's going to run for president. I think everybody in the Beltway would agree that he's not running for president. But what we have seen is we have seen Obama create an administration of empowerment. He has definitely empowered his cabinet, including the vice president, to be very decisive, very vocal surrogates on issues where maybe the president feels that he's not that well versed. Al?
I am nervous about this style thing that we're talking about, but where the president really has to get involved is when they've got an agreement. He's going to have to go out to the nation and sell, and Biden can't.
But there has to be something to sell.
I agree.
And that will define Obama, because he's supposed to be the one that brings people together and gets some
I wish he were more involved now than he is. But my point is that if they can reach agreement, then that will be forgotten, and it's whether he can go out and sell it.
Frank, Obama's got a history of making the promises for pre-election, after the election. Do you think that this is a situation where he's waiting for the other side to pull the trigger and then attack, rather than having to make the decisions he needs to make by implementing the budget, as we discussed earlier, and getting these two sides together? And he's sitting back and waiting for the Republican side to pull the trigger and hypothetically make the wrong decisions, the wrong statements, for them to just jump in.
I think that was part of the Democratic strategy some time ago, and then Paul Ryan made the proposal. So I don't think that's a very viable thing anymore. The Republicans have put something on the table, and it's being ignored. But the idea of who's going to put their toe in the water first has pretty well been answered.
Yeah, but Bob, what we're seeing is, and you know from your talks with Republican leadership on the Hill, at some point this game of chicken in the financial crisis is going to cause more fiscal disaster than anything. Is that in the mindset of the Republican leadership as we speak?
I think that everybody who's a player recognizes that they're playing with a bunch of firecrackers. They got a bomb in their hand, and it's going to go off relatively soon. And I think everybody is better get their act together. And I think that means everybody.
I don't see any way that either side can be sure they benefit from this thing.
Neither side can possibly benefit if we have any kind of a default.
But this goes back to a discussion we had 2 weeks ago. Al, you weren't here for that for that discussion. Or no, you were here. Bob, you were not here for this discussion. Where we talk about, you know, part of leadership is to make some critical discussions that might be painful to your son. And yet, everybody's sitting there saying, well, no, 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 it's going to be painless for my side. At some point, where's the pain threshold going to actually come into play?
Well, the country is going to have to go into a real tailspin for that, something like that to happen.
More so than we have now?
More so.
I think it's probably true that most people in the country are sitting back and looking at this thing up in Washington and thinking a pox on everybody.
Yeah, but I mean, Al, you've seen the numbers. I mean, right now, the credibility of Congress is at an all-time low. It's somewhere in the teens now.
It deserves to be.
But if it deserves to be, at what point does Congress take a look at what the polls are showing? Because we all know politics is about the polls in this town. The polls have got to be saying something to the members of Congress, particularly on the Democratic side, saying, hey, we've got the White House. We've got to be able to make something happen.
I've been asking that question for the last 5 years. I think the reason you have a Tea Party is because a whole bunch of people just got tired of the Hill doing nothing but bicker. That's been going on ever since Obama was elected. It's been going on before that.
Frank, CNN earlier gave a statement about Ron Paul state. He feels that the U.S. should just default. That kind of stuff coming from Ron Paul just throws more fodder into the already quagmire of all that we're dealing with.
We lose prestige and respect among the international community.
I mean, what is going to happen?
Well, obviously, and China has said that we're not buying any more treasury bonds.
If we go the way Ireland did Ireland is taking a hit.
Right. No one's going to bail us out. No. That's the bottom line.
What's it going to take though for us to say, okay, it's got to be done?
Okay, the country has to go into a real tailspin.
Okay, but going back to the politics of this, I mean, you know, when we see Mitch McConnell, you know, the administration is going to call Mitch McConnell's bluff by creating some sort of short-term extension or some sort of short-term Band-Aid fiscally. We still don't have a 2012 budget inside a budget cycle where that budget proposal should be already theoretically going to conference. Am I wrong in that, Al?
No.
So we don't have a budget. We don't have a budget conference going on. We don't have budget bills on either side of the House.
So the government shuts down. Then you have a major problem, especially if we haven't raised the debt limit.
Now we get back into the vicious circle. Bottom line here, when we look at what's happening, and we've got a caller right now on the air. Nothing to do with
we
that.
We just got hacked.
Wow.
We just got hacked.
Wow. You know. Here's the funny thing about it is, there's a thing on the internet called when you click on a link and Rick Astley video comes up on the screen, you got Rick rolled. We just got My Little Pony rolled. Thanks for your call.
You know, that may be the view of the country.
I was
right going to
say, basically, they look at Congress as My Little Pony, as a cartoon.
Great.
But ultimately, when we look at the financial stability, when we look at the debt ceiling, when we look at China becoming an increasing power, all the fuses are lit on this so-called firecracker that you talk about, Bob. At some point, you really have to sit down and look at both the administration and the Hill and saying, okay, there's got to be serious talks. There can't be any more drama queen actions like walking away from the table. Just sit down, lock yourselves in a room. Al, you suggested getting all of the political consultants out of the room. Just get them in a room, make a deal, make it happen. Is that a reality, Al?
No, I don't think under the current circumstances in Congress and people there that they would want to do that. But they should want to do that. The political hired guns are a part of the problem. The other thing that I think that I would like to bring up, or did you want to move on?
No.
I want to bring up is not only should the president go out and stand around the country, but it seems to me that a prominent Republican, the speaker being the most likely one, should also do the same thing. If Obama is out explaining to Democrats why they've done something to Social Security and Medicare, Boehner should be out talking about why it was essential to have a tax increase or cut military spending or whatever. And maybe they should go around together and do that.
Well, let's take a quick break. We're going to take a 2-minute break before the top of the hour. When we come back, let's touch on that, because that brings up another question. That brings up the question of Speaker Boehner. Speaker Boehner has actually done a good job about keeping out of the camera spotlight, but actually trying to make things happen in a fashioned house that he's now Speaker of. So we'll talk about that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Not My Little Pony. We'll be back in 2 minutes. We're back live here in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, America's premier cigar tavern. This is Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio. Joining us, as they do every Tuesday, Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winning. And joining us today in the studio is our old friend Frank the Bodyguard.
All right.
I want to continue the discussion. Al, you brought up a really solid point before. Just kind of remind the listeners, and by the way, if you're out there listening and you don't have a cartoon sound bite you'd like to play for us, you can dial in at 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. Al, bring up the comment you talked about before the break.
Well, it just occurs to me that one of the things that's got everybody in such a cowardly mood is they're all worried about how are they going to explain this to their side in the next election. And how are they going to put a good face on what they have done and that part of it that, that may be good. This is what we got. This is what we had to give up. And I think it's a process that should have started a long time ago. But it's not the end of the game yet. And I think that if Boehner could play golf again with the president and make an agreement that they would, in some fashion, go out and sell this to the government, to the public, collectively, together, that it would help both parties in terms of building some protection against their base attacking them for having given up or given in or however they would see it.
Bob?
There is no doubt in my mind that if the leadership in the Senate, in the House, and the President can reach an agreement, there is no doubt in my mind that something like Al is talking about is going to have to happen, absolutely have to happen. And that's just another reason why the time frames are so tough, because it's so short. I mean, that it's so difficult, to, and you can't just make one speech and
no.
do this. You're going to have to get out, and they're going to have to speak together and to the country, and they're going to have to speak separately to their own teams and help them understand why they gave something away that they some folks might not want them to give away, because there has to be a deal.
Well, you know, the one thing, and I mentioned this before, is the one person who I see who's got some credibility in this, who's not looking for a camera, is, in fact, Speaker Boehner. Speaker Boehner seems to be taking almost a backroom tactic of saying, look, let's just get a deal done, let's get this thing flowing. The success of this Congress, the success of the Obama first term depends on it. Is that an accurate assessment, Bob? You're pretty close to the leadership.
Well, let's not say I'm close to the leadership. That's unfair.
No.
But I, you know, I'm just...
He is, after all, a three-time parliamentarian.
Oh, I'm in marketing. That's what we do.
But it's clear to me that the only way to solve this problem is for the top decision makers in both parties to sit down together and cut a deal. And they have to do it quickly, and they have to go out, and they have, and Al is 100% right. They've got to sell it. I mean, the best thing that could possibly happen would be in the next, you know, a week or so, for both the Speaker and the President to be able to go on television jointly and say we've reached a deal, and then spend some time selling the deal to both their parties and to the public. More importantly, the public, because that's, if the public buys the deal, the parties have an easier time to be willing to give something.
And I think the public is still very confused about what's going on in Washington, D.C.
Oh, no question. No question. But let's, you know, one of the great mantras that we hear in business is, don't come to me with a problem, come to me with a solution.
Right.
If we were back in Congress, if, Al, you were back as a seated member, Bob, you happen to be a member of Bobtopia or whatever congressional district decided to elect you,
as nobody is that foolish.
Well, there is that. But look at, is there a logical solution that we could possibly, for anybody who's listening on the Hill, come up with and saying, look, this is how you do it bipartisan. It's going to be painful. What are some of the ideas that you'd have to possibly fix this now?
You mean fix the political problem?
Fix the actual budget crisis.
Oh, the budget crisis. Whether I lay out my priorities or you lay out yours or Bob lays out his, they're going to be unpopular.
Right.
So, first of all, they got to come to some conclusion, and they will know that it's going to be hard to sell their base, Republican or Democrat, and there are going to be some things in it they can brag about having protected both Republicans and Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to go out and sell the public on, one, the necessity of doing it, and two, Here's how we protected our base, giving up, and these are the things we had to give up in order to save the economy.
But if you were the minority leader in the House, what would you want to protect as a Democrat?
Well, you clearly want to protect Social Security and Medicare as best you can to try and get the best deal. I think there have got to be cuts there. But there are ways of doing that that are less or more harmful to senior citizens, and they should try to get...
Bob, what would you protect on the Republican side?
I would protect the... At this point, I would say no change in the tax laws as respect to the individual rates of taxation now. I think we have to wait to redo the tax code at a later date. And I know for a fact that that Dave Camp and the Ways and Means Committee in the House is looking at developing a draft of a change in the tax code, the first one since '86. But there are so many things that we could do. There are so many tax expenditures that run into hundreds of billions of dollars that could be changed, eliminated, reduced, what have you. And it would be how much you have to do of that would depend upon how much the Democrats are willing to give on their side. And that's where the negotiation has to be. And the only people that can do that are the top leaders.
You're out. What you're going to have to do, and this is what Ambassador Holbrooke did when he was trying to resolve the situation in the Balkans. He got the top leaders, they all went into a room, and they locked everybody in the room, including Holbrooke, for about 4 days. And nobody left until they came and they finally solved the issue. That was the only way they could do it.
Well, let's look at some of the top criteria that everybody's talking about in these deals, and Simpson Bowles called out a lot of this.
Mm-hmm.
Do we raise the retirement age, Al?
Mm-hmm.
That's a yes?
Excuse me. Well, that was a mouthful of martinis.
And Al's already into the martini.
It's the second hour.
What age?
I don't know. And I don't know how far out you need to start it. But some of this can be done in the out years. And clearly you got to protect people that are so old now that they don't have a chance to react to that in the time frame.
Now, raising the retirement age is obviously something that Democrats are going to fight against. That's a discretionary spending issue. That's not something that's going to be very popular. It's going to be somewhat painful to a few Democrats.
It will be a very painful thing.
But if you do it the way Bowles Simpson suggested, moving slowly up to, I think, 68 and touching nobody who is over 55.
Okay.
That's the kind of approach that would be necessary.
Okay. Do you touch, do you have a quasi-privatization of Medicare, Medicaid?
How do you have a quasi-privatization? I'm
vouchers.
I'm leery of those, but I would have to know more about what the specifics was. I could be persuaded.
Right.
But I'd have to see what the details are.
But you'd have to be at the table to be persuaded.
No, not necessarily. You were assuming I'm a member of Congress.
Right.
I would have to know, I would have to have faith in the people who are cutting the deal.
Yeah.
And I would probably then swallow hard and accept it if they did a good job. Yeah,
you'd have to, you know, on the Democratic side of the deal, you'd have to have the president... Mm-hmm. You'd probably have to have the leadership in the Senate and the House to sign on to giving away anything in the area of Medicare or health care, if you're a Democrat. Anything.
But now we look at the Republican side, mm-hmm. Bob. Do you do away with the Bush-era tax cuts?
Well, they're going to they expire for the wealthy next year.
Right.
And I think that probably you'd have to think real hard about letting that expire. I think also, but what you really want to do is, if you're the Republicans, again, I would go back to all these tax expenditures that we have, and I think that you could save as much money there without touching any of the tax law with respect to rates. You could probably get enough money there.
What about
you wouldn't have to change any of the tax rates until we change the tax laws as a whole, and they're going to have to be changed.
Do you look at, as a Republican, something that the Republicans have come out and flat out said, not on the table, do you come out with a flat tax?
No. I don't. Not now. Because there's no way to do that between now and in the first week in August. You can't do something that is that structurally big that quickly. But I think there are so many.
But we see proposals now talking about changing the tax code right now.
Well,
Wouldn't that be a possible tax code change?
Sure, absolutely.
Sure, but that's after we get over this.
Yeah, we got to get over this bump.
What about abolishing the alternative minimum tax?
I think it should be on the table.
I agree.
When you're doing the big tax reduction,
defense spending.
I think the Republicans have already said we're willing to talk about it.
Yes, they have.
Yeah.
Okay.
There was a
story in the Post saying that more and more Republicans are willing to do that. I haven't heard anything official.
No, nobody has. No leadership member has said we're willing to cut the fence in this area. 1, 2, 3.
Right.
But there are a lot of Republicans who see that the Pentagon wastes a lot of money just like other departments waste money. And they probably waste more money because they got more money.
Al, agricultural subsidies, do you touch them?
Mm-hmm.
You do?
Yes.
You know, 80% of those, I think, go to very wealthy farmers.
I think you could almost means test what you've got and save an enormous amount of money.
Speaking of means testing, do you means test Social Security?
I think we already have a little bit, and I do it a little. We did it when under Reagan, when he put together a bipartisan group that came up with some changes, and I remember that's the part that bothered me. I voted for that.
Yeah, and the wealthier people are getting less benefits than they used to get. Yeah.
And it bothered me because. It changed the fundamental nature of Social Security. And I kind of wanted to hang on to the old FDR, but it wasn't possible. And that was another case of where everybody had to vote. Everybody who voted for that had a whole bunch in it they didn't like, me included. But ultimately, you had to save Social Security, and so you voted for it.
Let's look at that for a second, because when you talk about compromise, you obviously made some compromises on the Social Security bill that you voted for.
Certainly.
Under Reagan. Who drove that? Was that the president, or was that leadership?
The president, I believe, set up the commission.
Yeah.
And it was an equal commission. Same number of Republicans and Democrats. It had, I remember, Claude Pepper, who was the greatest defender of Social Security the country has ever seen.
Right, because he was a recipient at the time. Right. He was needed in Congress.
He was from Florida, right?
Yeah. He would give these wonderful, passionate speeches on the floor that would draw applause. He was great. He was part of that commission. It was part of one of the reasons that the Democrats could come back and talk to Democrats and said, even Claude Pepper thinks this is necessary, and say, my God, if Claude says it's
all
right.
So if we could do that, I mean, going back to the days when there was a strong divide between Capitol Hill and the White House, you're talking about a Reagan White House and a Tip O'Neill Congress.
Yep.
When you look at that, why was that successful, and why can't we take that as a lessons learned today?
I think part of the reason is that nobody wants to turn that much power over to a commission. I mean, this was a commission where, when it came out, it was a take it or leave it. It wasn't, you're not going to play around with it.
But who determined take it or leave it? Was that was Speaker O'Neill?
I think that was O'Neill and Reagan agreeing that this was the only way we were going to solve it.
Is that viable today, Bob?
Well, it didn't work a couple of years ago when in the Senate, a bipartisan group of senators led by Kent Conrad, the chairman of the Budget Committee, had a resolution that said we are going to have a commission like Bowles Simpson, only instead of it giving a report, it's going to get voted on in the Congress. It has to get voted on if a majority of the commissioners vote for it. And, in effect...
And voted on as is.
As is.
Couldn't we have done this with Bowles Simpson?
Well, we could. Yeah, we could vote on Bowles Simpson in the Senate, in the House, today if we wanted to.
Why won't anybody take that up? Now?
Well, the leadership doesn't want to bring it up.
That's right.
That's the reason. But
the leadership isn't wanting to do it.
The reason that I had hope for the vice president's proposal before the Republicans walked out on it, for whatever reason, was that they would come up with something like that. But the fact is, as we learned with base closing, there are some issues which politically cannot be, you cannot expect members to not vote their district if it's, if you can amend it, if you can change it, if you got to vote it up or down.
You got to vote it up or down. And that's that was one of the geniuses of the base closing vote.
Brack had the commission. The commission voted on it. It was an up and down vote.
That's right.
Is an up and down type situation the way we get out of this current stalemate?
It's the way I would be.
It's the way that Ken Conrad and his people tried to do it a couple of years ago, and they weren't able to get it even onto the floor, and so the president created the Bowles-Simpson Commission, which was basically structured on the resolution and never was able to pass the Congress.
Now, Ralph, one of the other aspect that we haven't talked about in this fiscal crisis is the trade deficit. The trade deficit is killing this economy. What do we put on the table to help compromise on trade deficit?
Well, the Republicans are really pushing to eliminate the death tax.
Say that again?
The Republicans are really pushing to eliminate the death tax.
The death tax. I object.
Yeah.
Why?
I object.
Why do you object?
The death tax is a Republican National Committee phrase ending to try and make sound very, very terrible what is in fact called
an estate tax.
And I have some sympathy. I had a whole bunch of dairy farmers in my district. In fact, a huge amount of them. And you can run a dairy farm and not make much money, but have millions of dollars invested in your equipment and your cows and all the rest of that stuff. So that if you make that too low, if you put the threshold at which the estate tax kicks in too low, you leave the heirs with no possibility but to sell it because they can't pay the money out to do it. So you've got to draw your lines with great care. But the idea that really rich people are sending millions of dollars to their heirs untaxed is ridiculous.
No, call them on it. Try it out and see what happens. I think the other thing the U.S. is going to have to do is sign more free trade agreements. We have Korea and they have Panama,
Colombia,
on the table.
And free trade agreements.
But just before that, you said, try it out and see what happens.
Oh, well, I mean, allow the repeal of the debt of the estate tax and see what happens.
Well, I'm saying,
there are a lot of
do it with a scalpel, not with a meat axe.
Yeah, you know what you have to do is find a reasonable number where the middle income families wouldn't have to pay taxes on the first dollar that they wanted that their heirs would get. Wealthy people, you know, can pay taxes. A guy who's got $100 million to leave to his heirs isn't going to worry about a tax that is reasonable. If you go so low that everything over $1 million gets taxed, that's probably unreasonable. But maybe the first $4 million or something like that, pick a number that's reasonable and then index it, and you've got it made.
I want to go back to the scenario that Al brought up in his constituency. You know, this is back 16, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
We're now in an agricultural economy where corporate farmers now rule the world. The day of the individual family farmer is gone. So
it's pretty much gone. You still have some in dairy and a few other things.
Very few of the agricultural hierarchy is based on family farming versus corporate farming. It's all owned by ADM and the corporate world.
Well, there you go. Yeah. See, now take for example, I think probably about 80% of the dollars at least that are in agriculture benefits go to these corporate farmers. So if you decided, you find a way to decide what's a reasonable number, and if your revenues are above that number,
there's a tax on your, we eliminate the agriculture benefits for these big corporate farmers and let the family farmers who still exist, give them still some support, and you take that money and you put that into the pot when you're trying to negotiate a deal to find ways to raise some money.
And make it apply to the locally owned stationery store.
Yeah.
They have a huge investment in inventory and what have you. And all the little guys are not little bitty guys.
No.
You know, and you. The idea should be to put some economists saying, where is the point that we could cut? We could cut this off and leave most small businessmen, including farmers, able to pass on their business to their children,
yeah,
and they can find that point,
yeah,
and then tax have an inheritance tax above that,
and it can be done.
But these are all ideas that we've managed to in the past 20 minutes or so come up with as possible solutions to getting over this political hurdle that is currently exists in Washington. If it's so easy for a bunch of guys sitting around drinking martinis and Jack Daniels and smoking cigars, one would think that it should be this easy for members of Congress to get around and say, we can do the same.
Well who is going to re-elect you?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good point.
Or
My
me.
Little Pony.
Or My Little Pony. Or Bob. Or, you know.
There's got to be an emphasis for that.
Yeah, there are all, you know, once you start saying we're going to pick a number and say above that your estate can be taxed and below that you're okay, all the people above that, you know, they can afford all kinds of lobbyists and public relations people, and they do. And they make major contributions to campaigns, to members of committees which write these kind of laws, the tax laws. And those committees aren't going to act, and their local Congress people are going to get, you know, told they don't want any change. And pretty soon what happens is everybody backs off. Nobody says, I don't want to be the person who loses my race because the rich people and the rich corporations and the rich farmers or whoever who are mad at me, they're going to be pour lots of money into my opponent, and I'm going to lose my primary.
But at some point, there's got to be, is somebody ever going to stand up and say, look, I'm going to take this silver bullet, I'll make tons of money on K Street, but I'm going to actually stand up and say, regardless of whether I get reelected or not, I'm going to make a tough decision.
I can remember when there was a time when there were a few members who would do that. I keep searching for one now.
That it gets done is if it's part of a package which seems to be reasonably fair and is not it is not punitive to anybody, but it's fair to everybody.
But you can't make it is diametrically impossible.
Wherever you draw the line, it has to be a reasonable line that seems to be fair. And if you have enough different pieces of a package, so that there are benefits and negatives, it's a lot easier to do that. It's just like the budget talks. You know, it's a lot easier if there's a package to put together that are gives and takes. Once it's all on one side, you have a problem.
Yeah, but you're talking about a painless solution.
There is no painless solution.
Exactly, that's my point.
That's my point too. But as long as you don't lose your right arm, you might lose a finger. That's all right. You can live with only four fingers if it's a little finger. It's not your thumb, and it's not your right arm or your left leg. It's just your little finger. If you can find deals like that, which you can do if you want to, you can make a package up that most people will say, that's reasonable, that's fair.
But Al, we're seeing a Congress that's not even willing to give up their lending finger.
That's right.
Well, the bottom line is everyone wants to get reelected, and they're not willing to go the extra mile and do what's in the best interest of the country.
You know, that's
why I said earlier, you have to put people in the room and lock the doors, and they aren't getting out until the thing gets solved. That's the bottom line.
But one of the things that I noted in my 16 years in Congress was that every vote that I would go home and lose sleep over, because I thought I would lose the election over, never, ever became political issue in my campaign.
Right.
Politicians are paranoid. They have every right to be paranoid. People are really after them. You know?
Well, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that they're not after you.
Well, I'll bet you had more trouble than people talking about a pay raise for a congressman every couple of years than you did about big issues that affected all kinds of kinds of interests.
True, and it also depends on when the controversial issue comes. If it comes at the beginning of a term, it's forgotten by the end of the term.
Yeah, Ralph.
Raising the pay raise is fine unless the country is suffering. And that was my big issue with the last pay raise. We were in a recession. Why should Congress be raising their pay when people are struggling to find a job?
My experience was there is always something going on that is a good argument for not raising your pay. And I remember my predecessor getting a card. It's a wonderful, wonderful card which he had framed, and he put it right next to the door into his office. He had voted to raise his salary to $46,500. $46,500. And the card said, "Dear Congressman Means, $46,500, you son of a bitch," and signed the thing. You know. Well, we now it's 170
some odd thing.
And in my era, that was less than most of the major school district superintendents had made.
The 46,000
in my the 40s.
Yeah, right.
Well, the 40s. Even when I was there and I was making 120, whatever it was, most of the major superintendents were making more than that. So what I always told my people about pay raises was, I believe the job is worth it. It is your job to elect somebody who you think is worth it.
As a citizen, I think I can speak that we see congressmen, senators, as the elite that vote for their own pay raises, but then what do we get that bang out of the buck? We're coming up to a deadline. At what point do we, and we got the Tea Party coming up, we got Democratic shift back over to the Republican side, when does it stop? When does it become, okay, look, you want your pay raise? Get into that room, like you suggested, and lock the door. Then
right.
You get your pay raise.
Well, you make an excellent point. In that, as I've said before on this program tonight, that they've been bickering. They've not been doing the job, and so I think you're right to be offended by that pay raise. But we're not talking pay raises
right.
here in
general. Not, that's not the subject at hand. It's trying to get out of the fiscal crisis.
Well,
and we're
why don't we cut Congress? See how they
were responding. Hold on. I mean, the reality is that, you know, with the fiscal crisis, and we're not going to solve it here, but it just amazes me that, you know, whether it's a package deal, what we've talked about could become part of a package deal.
Right.
And nobody's even willing to put the pieces of a package puzzle together, which is why we're in the current state that we are. Something's got to give. Now, hopefully, between now and next Tuesday, when we reconvene, there will be some sort of package. There's talk in the streets of Washington. There may be a package close at hand.
But it's up to Obama to now intervene and say, look, guys, we've all got to come together.
You want to know something? I got to tell you something. I don't think that putting the focal point on the president is not the solution. Not when you have somebody like Joe Biden right there, ready to go with the experience he has. Look, if I'm President Obama, knowing that my total term of federal service is less than his Senate term, I want somebody who I can empower as a surrogate to say, hey, you know what? You speak for me. I have empowered you to speak for me. If you say something on this topic, you're speaking for the presidency. Bob.
I couldn't disagree with you more, only because to the general public, the president is the agenda setter. He is the president. He has got to get in the room and sit down there himself. That way, the public feels that the guy who is the agenda setter and the decision maker on so many things
He's the guy who can take us to war. He's the guy who can do anything, can decide what the policy is. It's his job to set the agenda. It's his job to make sure the deal gets cut. He's got to sit in the room with anybody else he wants, but he's got to be in the room.
But how hard is it? How hard is it?
It's a psychological thing for the public.
I understand that. I understand that. But how hard is it for him to go in front of the American people at 8 o'clock on prime time saying, look, we have a financial crisis here. I, as president, am dealing with a financial crisis at home. I'm dealing with a three-war front, and I'm having to deal with everything else in running government. It is my prerogative, and it is my executive privilege to say, when it comes to the budget issue, when you guys talk to the vice president, he speaks for me.
I don't think he has the experience to do that.
Obama ran on the fact that he would be the one that would solve the problem.
But
he was going to bring the change.
Well, anyway.
The president has to be there.
All right,
he's got to take the leadership role.
He said he sent Senate leadership up to talk to people and try to cut deals. He sent commissions up to try to get deals done and settled. He sent the vice president up to he's done everything but get in the room himself. It's time to get in the room.
Well, we're not going to solve that, obviously, here today. We're coming up at the bottom of the hour. When we come back, we want to talk politics. We're going to talk about Michelle Bachmann and the continuing evolving fluffiness of the GOP ticket for the 2012 election. This is Backroom Politics Live. You like that? Fluffy. This is Backroom Politics Live from Chili's Backroom in Washington, D.C. Easy, boys, easy. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Fluffy.
Here in Chili's back room, an ever-growing audience here in the back room of Backroom Politics. Well, we're going to switch channels right now.
Five.
Yeah, there's more than that. That doubles it. Anyway, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the political goings on the GOP ticket this week, yesterday. Michelle Bachmann, the Congresswoman, the junior Congresswoman from Minnesota, a very established tax attorney, has thrown her hat in the ring for the presidential nomination of the Republican Party in 2012. Michelle Bachmann, I got to tell you something. Well, let me ask this question. Bob, as a Republican, what do you think about Michelle Bachmann announcing?
I think she has every right to.
Very diplomatic, very political. Al?
How do you top that?
Well, there's an article in today's Politico that says that she has never had a piece of legislation that she sponsored been signed into law.
Neither had Obama.
Good point. Good point.
It's irrelevant.
That is one of the single dumbest charges that can be made against any member of Congress.
Why?
Because the participation in legislation does not restrict itself to passing legislation. I participated in a lot of legislation in a major way that did not have my name on it. But I was active. I've had some legislation with my name on it. I was in there for 16 years. Maybe there were four or five pieces that had my name on it. Not one per year. How long has she been in Congress?
5 years. Can I just say one thing about that? What Al is saying. Having worked with him for his
many
entire
years.
Career in
right.
Congress when I was with NBC, I don't know what legislation Al thinks is the most important that he passed, but I can tell you this. A great deal of legislation that was bad didn't get passed, and good legislation did get passed because Al worked so hard across the aisle with his own party and with the Republicans getting things done. He was very, very effective.
Well, I mean, go ahead, Al.
And so this idea that you have to pass something with your name on it, first of all, the minority is always at a disadvantage because the chairman of the committee it's coming out of always issues his with his name on it. You can do all the work, but it's going to come. I remember, and I wasn't aware of this, I was very naive, but I remember a piece of legislation that Ham Fitch introduced, and it passed with his name on it, and he congratulated me. This was the ranking Republican on the Judiciary Committee, very, very senior, and he said, I have never had a Democrat take one of my bills and leave my name on it. Well, how dumb was I? I didn't know that I could make it my own. You know, all I had to do was
sign off on it.
Was to bring it up as my own bill, which I didn't want to do to him. I had enormous respect for it. So there are all kinds of reasons why the amount of legislation you pass is no measure of your effectiveness.
So you think that this is an unfair allegation on Michelle Bachmann's experience?
I think I would be much more interested in an evaluation of how hard she worked in the legislative process. And my view, from what I understand, is she hasn't done very much in that.
Well,
but
I think you have to look and see, is she able to work with the other side in passing legislation? And also you have to look and see what are her international credentials in terms of what kind of relationships does she have with China, with Europe, and the Middle East? And what are her policies?
Well, does that necessarily, theoretically, President Obama didn't have a lot of international experience at all.
Well, he had a lot of support among the international community.
Well, that was because he wasn't Bush, or he wasn't a Republican.
Right.
I mean, let's be real.
You have to evaluate it on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah.
I don't know what she's done internationally. I know she's a very good tax attorney. She has knowledge of international tax issues, which
are
very
beneficial. The most important thing that you can want to know about a candidate is how they think about the issues. What kind of an intellectual rigor they bring to it? What kind of people that they, what kind of people does she listen to? what are her basic fundamental beliefs. Those things are much more important because those are the kind, those are what she is going to bring to every issue that comes to her desk were she to be the president. That's the most important thing, and that we don't know yet about
yeah.
her to a great extent because she hasn't been in Congress very long. She hasn't made lots of public speeches on policy issues. She's been engaged within the Tea Party. We know that, but we don't know a whole lot more than that.
But are we seeing the evolution of the Tea Party getting their foot in the water, or their foot in the door early enough to at least try and help drive platform for the greater GOP?
Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely.
Is Michelle Bachmann's entry into the race part of that tactic?
I think Michelle Bachmann is entering the race because she believes she can win the nomination. And I don't think they encouraged her to do it.
She's co-opted the Tea Party.
Yeah, I think the Tea Party was eager to have her do it, but I think she decided that she was going to do it herself without any regard to whether the Tea Party spoke up for her or not. You know, if Palin got in, I'm sure that a lot of the Tea Party people would think she's one.
Well, that brings up the question is, does Palin jump in at this point?
I don't think she does. I think Michelle Bachmann has sort of taken over the role.
And that's impressive in and of itself. That Michelle Bachmann could bump that...
That governor.
With all the advantages she had out of the race.
And take a look at this. Right. 2 weeks ago, we had a debate where all the announced or likely to announce candidates, anybody who wanted to be there was invited to be there. She probably came off better at that debate than any of the people that she was standing there with. There were seven people there, and the six gentlemen that she was up there with did not do as well as she did.
A surprising poll number coming out of Des Moines was, in a straw poll, she's in a statistical dead heat with Mitt Romney.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. Now, what does that tell you? Well, I think it says more about the group of candidates than it does about Michelle Bachmann. I think she made a very good impression in the debate, and she has a strong follower.
In short, what you just said is it says more about Mitt Romney than it does about her.
Yes, it does.
How so?
Well, because if he were as popular as he would like to be, he would be way ahead in the poll. But now
theoretically, we're still in preseason.
We are in preseason.
I mean, this is spring training for all intents and purposes. And what bugs me about all of this is the fact that we're now seeing a presidential election cycle starting to go to the 2-year mark, almost 2.5. On a first-term president, honestly, I don't think that's fair. I don't think it's fair to start jockeying for position. No matter how much you want to take back the White House, you're going to take back the White House if your platform is strong and your candidate's strong. Whether you start January 1st of 2012 or you start back in June of 2010. That's the bottom line here, kids. Go ahead, Ralph.
Whatever people want to say about Michelle Bachmann, fact of the matter is, you know where she stands on the issues. She doesn't hide the ball. And it's been the biggest criticism of Romney is that he has changed his position on several issues, including abortion. Don't see that with Michelle Bachmann. She comes across as being very honest, down to earth, and says what she means, whether you agree with her or not.
But she's also come out and made some pretty amateurish gaffes. I mean,
that's true.
The John Wayne comment in Waterloo is surprisingly amateurish.
But I'm talking about her belief on the issue.
Yeah, but
you know where she stands.
But it also goes back to her credibility. Al, you're cringing. Go ahead.
Well, we know where she stands on the issue she talks about.
Right. That was my whole point.
We don't know where she stands on a whole bunch of stuff.
Right.
That was my point about what is her basic belief.
Well, she's basically going to have to be vetted throughout this whole process coming out.
All the candidates are going to have to be vetted. That's why they're all out there now trying to raise money and talking to people and trying to build support.
But Al, are we seeing a Republican? I mean, it almost seems like the Republicans are starting to delude themselves. Is at some point, this number could get up to the latest number I heard with the governor Rick Perry of Texas talking about getting in.
We've even heard Bob McDonald, his name being bantered around, the governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia.
And he quickly said,
absolutely not. But we theoretically could have a GOP ticket race of 12 candidates.
I would remind you that in 1968, I believe that at one point there were 21 Democrats who were talking about or running, including people like Shirley Chisholm and Birch Bayh and all kinds of people.
You have an incumbent president, the opposition party is likely to fill out enormously.
Sure.
Yeah, but like you said, this is the first time we've seen a opposition ticket this broad since 68.
No, I don't think so.
When was it bigger?
Yeah. Well, how many? Let's go back.
Possibly 80?
Well, now, how many Republicans were running 3 years ago for the presidency?
There were, at one time, I think the number was 6.
Okay, we got 7 now.
No, we got 9 now.
All announced?
All announced.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, we got 3 more. Big deal.
Okay.
Big deal. I mean, really, you got a right to run if you want to. If you think you can lead the country, you have a right to announce.
But let's not forget it is so early.
But the Republicans run the risk of tearing each other apart.
That's our fear. Well, that's the fear, at least I have.
That's what's, again, against it.
They always have it.
But one of the things that came out in Michelle Bachmann's announcement is the GOP is not lining up people to run for her possibly vacant seat.
It's only a week. He's only been announced a week. Give him a little time.
Well, Al, in the theory of politics being perception, you would think that the GOP, at least in Minnesota, knowing that this is a possibility, would at least have some names to throw out there to at least try and vet for a possible run for her seat. It's almost as if the GOP party is saying, you know what, we're not sure she's even going to be there.
I think that's a very wise judgment.
I do, too. I don't think, if I'm a leading Republican in the state of Minnesota, I don't think I want to start sounding as though Michelle Bachmann is going to be removed from her congressional seat, whether she likes it or not, and whether she gets a nomination. If she doesn't get the nomination, she's going to stay in the House.
The Tea Party is driving her candidacy, and they have a lot of votes in these primaries. It'll be very interesting to see how her candidacy evolves, because as you said, she has made some gaps, but she's clear on where she stands on the issue, as opposed to some of the other candidates.
Like Al pointed out and Bob pointed out, we've seen her come out with some credibility on the issues that she wants to bring to the table.
What about the other issues?
The other issues, there's still a lot more. You know, we haven't heard her truly come out and talk about the War Powers Act issue, for example. We haven't heard her come out and talk about international affairs or trade relations.
Well, we can solve that by inviting her to come on our show and talk about that.
And we're not at that point in the election process yet, where the question of can she beat Obama? And I think Bachmann versus Obama is not one that would make me terribly comfortable as a Republican.
No.
It would delight me as a Tea Party person, but then
I agree.
They're not practical.
You got to take a break. You got to take a break. We're going to take a break here real quick, and we're going to come into our last segment, which is going to be Freeform. It's our ever-popular Tell Me a Story segment. Stay with us. This is Backroom Politics, live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room in Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Jones to bring us into our last segment here at Backroom Politics, here live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. And now it's time for our ever famous, oh, it's a picture of Michelle Bachmann on the CNN TV screen here.
President of the United States.
So this is our ever popular and always famous Tell Me a Story segment, where we go around to the roundtable regulars, Bob, Al, Ralph, and myself. And we go around and we try and get a scoop on the local political story that's going to happen that nobody knows about. Ralph and Bob seem to be in the lead with scooping everybody. Al and I just moderate, and Al just sits there and enjoys his martini and cigar. But Al, you want to give a shout out.
I just wanted to say that I met a guy in my workout who I told about the program, and he said, I'm going to go listen to that. Went back to my office and listened to that. If he hasn't left, because he probably got off at 5 o'clock, but I wanted to say, Larry, I hope you listened. I enjoyed it, and you demonstrated to us a whole new idea. We need to go out and recruit listeners one by one, which reminds me of an old Bob Hope story when he was pitching Pepsodent on his program. And in the middle of a commercial he had lived, and he said, folks, either we do it this way or they make us crawl through the drains and poke it at you with a stick.
And Al using the poke it at you with a stick method to get more listeners. That's fantastic. All right, we're going to start off. Ralph, tell me a story.
All right, I actually have two. One is domestic, one is international.
Okay, what's the domestic one?
Okay, in the next 6 months, the Democrats will propose a second stimulus bill in return for agreeing to vote to raise the debt limit. The stimulus will pass.
Wow.
My second point, as Pakistan's relationship with the U.S. Gets worse, Pakistan's relationship with India will keep improving and going somewhere.
Really?
Yes.
So you're thinking that the mortal enemies of India and Pakistan, who are still fighting to this day over Kashmir, are actually becoming closer because we're so ticked off at the ISI?
They're going somewhere.
Wow. Interesting. Al?
I first of all want to say to Ralph that, you know, you're the smartest kid in the class, and I hate you.
Nice.
Well, that's because I get you in a headlock.
Wow.
Okay.
No more headlock. No more headlock.
My story is last week, I said that Nancy Pelosi might turn out to be the biggest hindrance to passing
some sort of budget solution.
Yeah. Since Eric Cantor came out of the White House, if we are to believe what he said, I would say he has obviated that. He will be.
You're saying Eric Cantor, the majority leader, is going to be the biggest hurdle in getting a fiscal package back.
If we are to believe what he says,
no?
I'm perfectly willing to have him lying.
He's definitely pushing all the signs and saying, look, you know, all fiscal issues got to go through him ultimately, which... Is that going to resonate well with Speaker Boehner?
They're on the same page.
They are on the same page.
They're on the same page.
Interesting.
He might have said a little bit different than the Speaker might have, but they're on the same page.
A very interesting observation, Bob. Bob, tell me a story.
I'm going to enlarge a little bit on something I said last week. John Huntsman started his campaign too about 10 days ago. He hasn't made quite the splash that Ms. Bachman has.
Right.
But he's not that kind of a person.
Right.
He started a little slowly, I think, but he's raising money. He's got some good people joining his team, and I think we're going to hear a lot more of him.
Where's Huntsman's base going to be? He's fighting for the same corporate money that Romney seems to have a stranglehold on. Is he going to be able to dislodge some of that corporate money going forward, do you think?
There's no doubt that he can.
How?
He's got family connections. He does not have the problem of being seen as someone who has changed his views on some significant issues, as Mr. Romney has. He hasn't got the problem of carrying the Massachusetts health care bill as the model for Obamacare on his back. So he has a lot of support from people who might like Romney if Romney was Huntsman, so to speak.
Is Huntsman the dark horse that everybody should be shadowing right now?
I think so.
Interesting. Interesting talk. Okay. Good. Tell me a story. Ralph.
Yes.
Any travels coming up?
Yes. I am going to be going to Northern California to meet with a client on Tuesday.
No, I meant, because last time we saw you, you had a picture of you and the president of Mongolia.
Yes,
The truly economic power that Mongolia is.
Well, Mongolia now, their new president, Western trained and educated, but has very strong credentials with Russia. After he came to the U.S., he met with the Chinese and the Russians.
Really?
Right. I got an opportunity to meet with him when he came to the United States and had a picture taken with him. I'm very impressed with his knowledge of world affairs and his desire to work closely with the United States.
Wow, is he going to be able to bridge that divide between Beijing and Mongolia?
I think so.
Really?
And he is someone that you would definitely want to have dealing with North Korea, because Mongolia and North Korea still maintain very close relationships, unlike the Chinese North Korean relationships, which are starting to erode as you have the Chinese moving towards more of the Western-style system of capitalism. That really has angered the North Korean government, which still supports the radical Marxist-Leninist Juche philosophy.
Does he have the credibility to bridge Beijing and Mongolia?
I think he does, yes.
Wow, very interesting.
So that meeting in Beijing was very, very important after coming to the U.S.
Right.
So
Frank,
watch out for him.
Just a footnote, I've been named National Sales Director for Veritas Cigars, which you gentlemen have been enjoying this afternoon. I just wanted to get a quick read on everybody's cigar. Al?
Excuse me, I was filled with martini at the time, which was very good. I had one of your lighter cigars.
Right.
It was a very good cigar.
Thank you.
I have not been into your big, heavy one, which I may not have until after dinner.
Bob?
So I'll give you a report later.
Thank you.
I had the same feeling Al did. I had one of those mild cigars. I enjoyed it immensely.
Okay.
And this has been a paid political announcement.
Yeah, well, you know, by the way, Veritas wants to sponsor solely Backroom Politics. They can.
Yes. I'll write you a check right now. I have crayons.
For $250 a month.
My Little Pony is a sponsor. What do you think of the cigar that I gave you?
I'll tell you something. I got to tell you something. Since we are based in a cigar bar, we should talk about the cigars we're smoking every once in a while. I got to tell you something. I had the mild one, fantastic smoke. The three band,
the tripper wrap,
is a fantastic smoke so far. I literally just lit it in the last segment, but so far it's a really good smoke.
It's
kudos.
The only triple wrap in the industry right as we speak. The only triple wrap. Veritas Cigars. And you can go to frankthebodyguard.com and see all the information on it.
It's got Connecticut wrapper, and then
it's got natural.
Then there's
sun-grown,
some Reynolds wrap, and
aluminum foil.
Yeah.
One thing I want to say.
Yes, Bob.
With respect to Mongolia, I think Ralph is exactly right. I mean, they could be very significant. The last time Mongolia interjected itself into world affairs, it took over half the world. So remember, Genghis Khan may be coming back in a different form.
Please tell me that you have not just compared the current head of state in Mongolia to Genghis Khan.
Well, let me put it this way. I don't think he has the firepower that they had a thousand years ago. 800 years ago
Short of pitchforks and sticks, I think we're pretty... They're not going to be a major Cold War between...
Mongolia is a country that's definitely on the rise. And in a very good, positive way that can help in a lot of different situations.
Interesting. You know what? Yeah. If the president of Mongolia would love to come on, we'd love to have him on the show.
90 seconds.
And that's our cue. Yeah. We've got 90 seconds to the end of the show. It's been a great show, everybody. On behalf of Congressman Al Swift, Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie, I'm your moderator, J.T. Russell. This has been Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, right across the street from the National Press Club. If you're in town, come on by, have a smoke, have a drink. Prices are reasonable, and Bob takes good care of us.
Not this, Bob.
On behalf of everybody with Backroom Politics and the First Congress Society, thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week. Tuesday, 4 to 6 Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio. Have a great, great week, everybody.